Welcome back, or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I am your host, Finn Melanson, and this episode is part of a brand new mini-series we are calling The Long Run Archives, in which I am joined by Brett Hornig, a fellow ultra runner and coach at Trails and Tarmac. We are going to riff on some of ultra running's most intriguing news, debates, and questions. You know those fantastic long run conversations you have with friends that you wish you could have hit the record button on? The goal with these episodes is essentially to recreate those moments. In this first episode, we go back and forth on whether it's a competitive advantage to be a full-time ultra runner, how different our sport would be if Jim Walmsley had never missed that turn at mile 90 during the 2016 Western States 100. We do a preview of the golden ticket race at the Black Canyon 100K, and we conclude with some chatter about great finds on Strava and other news in our sport, including the entrance of one of the greatest American runners of all time. I'm excited for this one. Let's get started. Brett Hornig, welcome to the Single Track Podcast.
Hey, Finn. Thanks for having me.
And I can say this is definitely not the last time, because just for context, a couple weeks back on a recent podcast episode, I put it in the outro of the show that I wanted to create a new segment or a new series, kind of in the vein of ESPN First Take, sports talk radio, stuff like that. And you and I connected, and now we're here, and we're not exactly sure what this is going to look like in the long run, but we have a couple things lined up. And I do want to give you the opportunity just to give an elevator pitch on your background in the sport before we get started. So what should the listeners know about you?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. My name is Brett Hornig. I coach for Trails and Tarmac. I've been coaching runners since 2014, trail and ultra runners since 2016. I've also, you know, tried to dip my toes in the competitive pool of trail and ultra running for the last few years. And yeah, it's a blast. Ran for Southern Oregon University prior to that. And yeah, I mean, this episode kind of idea of just chit-chatting about all things trail and ultra, things that we find interesting that hopefully some other people will find interesting as well, as really exciting.
I'm not sure if it was Ryan Gelfi or Eric Gelfi that told me this, but there's this legend at the University of Southern Oregon where you either die on the track or you live long enough to see yourself become a mountain ultra trail runner. Is that pretty true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the amount of alums from Southern Oregon University that have, you know, raced a 50K or longer has got to be one of the bigger numbers from any running school.
So we got, for this episode in particular, we're doing three segments. The first is some sort of hot debate topic in the sport. Then we're going to transition to an ultra running what if, sort of the butterfly effect as it applies to ultra running. We'll also talk about the Black Canyon 100K. We'll preview the men's and women's fields, the competitive side of the race. And then we'll each offer a hot take that's outside the box of all that stuff mentioned. And then we also have this segment of trail running news and weird things that Brett has found on Strava. So I think I count like six or seven segments there. We'll see how this goes. I think it could be good, man. We've been chatting the past week or so, developed pretty good rapport. I'm amazed by your depth of knowledge in the sport, and maybe this thing will take off. So let's get started with the debate question, which is, does going full-time on ultra running as a professional athlete give you an advantage? You want to start with it?
Sure. Yeah. This is definitely something that, you know, not the first time I've thought of it, and, you know some people who have been full-time ultra runners are. It seems very, very difficult to do. And I guess what I mean by that is that a lot of these professional ultra runners that have nothing to do but run seem to overdo it a little bit from time to time. For some people, there definitely needs to be that balance. I guess the other variable that would come into this is a lot of these professional ultra runners have done it self-coached, which I think in most cases has not been perhaps the best choice. So perhaps that could go into why I think that a lot of these ultra runners need something else to do to fill their time instead of just running.
I think this is going to be an interesting debate because I think I have a strong opinion on the opposite side, but let me ask a couple clarifying questions first. So because you're a coach and you coach a lot of elite athletes in our sport as well, when you say nothing to do but run, as a coach, do you think that there's a lot more that goes into being a professional ultra runner than like getting out there and slogging miles and doing workouts?
I think there is now. The level of competition in ultra running is as high as it's ever been. And there's just not going to be those people really anymore that are going to win, you know, 8 major ultras in a year. You have to bring your absolute best to the starting line. And in order for that to happen, I think there are things outside of just running a lot that need to take place as a, you know, professional ultra runner to have success on the, on like the world stage, really. You know, if you're in the podium of some of the biggest races in the world, you're doing a lot more than just running.
Yeah, I think that, and myself included, for a long time, I always thought that if you were a pro ultra runner, basically you got your miles in whenever you wanted to during the day. And then the rest of the day, your goal was to stay as horizontal as possible, watching Netflix or HBO. But I look at people like Tom Evans, and this is the reason why I take such a strong stance on going all in. I look at people like Tom Evans who aren't just running, but they're like these incredible students of the sport. Like they're diving into every single race report that ever existed on UTMB. They're seeing a sports psychologist, a masseuse, a physio. They're going to the gym for strength training. And the way they describe it, there's not enough hours in the day to do everything that they need to do to be on that start line contending for the win. And I'm just of the opinion that that's just going to scale. There's going to be 25 Tom Evanses by 2024 at UTMB. And if you're not a Tom Evans, and if you don't have the luxury of 24 hours a day thinking about running, you're going to be at a disadvantage.
I think you're partially correct in that that's certainly going to help. I'm sure I would be a better runner if I had the best coaches in the world and the best facilities, all the right testing to make sure that everything I'm doing is absolutely optimized. But I don't think that means that if you don't have those things, you can't get to that point. Because if you don't have those things to succeed, how do you ever become a professional ultra runner? And I think there are going to be those people who can just grind and get up to that stage while, you know, still working on other things. And there's people like that, even in the track and road sections of the world that are still crushing it. You know, like the American record holder in the marathon on the lady side, the fresh one, fresh American record, Kira D'Amato. She's a real estate agent too. And she just ran 2:19 in the marathon, like faster than any American woman's ever run before. Is she a 2:15 person if she just focuses only on running all the time? I don't know.
That what if is incredible. I think you make an incredibly good point. And like another person that comes to mind is Bill Rogers back in the 70s. Like that guy was running 2:10 and he was getting his miles in running to and from work as a school teacher, which is incredibly taxing in its own right. So I guess one of the things that I think about, maybe I'll throw this back to you, is like when I think of other sports like lacrosse or basketball, there's a lot of practice you can do that isn't physically taxing on your body. Like in basketball, you can shoot free throws, or in lacrosse, you can, you know, shoot against the net. Tennis, you can play against a wall, and you're not like taxing your body in this unsustainable way. Is there something in running that's the equivalent of shooting free throws where you're not going out there and putting incredible stress in your legs, but you're still getting in some sort of reps that are beneficial?
I think the mental training side of running is something that's very largely unexplored, especially in ultra running, where so many people will say from miles 60 to 100, it's mostly just between the ears. Even if you run a well-paced 100 mile, like at 100K, your body still feels crappy. But if you can just be okay with that discomfort, like you can still have a great race. And I think so many people just jump into these races with that sort of unknown. It's like, well, there probably are ways to train the mind for things like this, largely in regards to finding that flow state. Like, what do I need to do to hold that sort of focus and not, you know, let my thoughts wander or focus wander? Because then, you know, you start falling, you start losing track of time, things like that. And I think that's something that can be practiced. I don't know exactly how. It seems like a lot of the best, like, distance runners on the track side of the world, they play a ton of video games. Like, you have to, like, you get to be competitive. You get to focus. Like, you don't blink for 5 hours. And then you're hyper-focused and you're just training your mind. Like, you're not losing focus or anything, because if you do, you lose. I've always found a parallel to racing cars and running races. I love racing go-karts and the kind of focus that you need to lay down, you know, like, your perfect lap time. You can't make any mistakes. And I think that's, like, something along those lines is great mental focus for keeping the brain engaged.
Okay. You just made me think of something. So thank you. And that is, football is another great example of this, because the sport is so taxing, because even a practice, like, they're just two giant human beings are colliding and creating damage on each other and pain. They've actually started to practice in reality less and less. And these guys are wearing, like, VR headsets to do all of the simulation of practice on these screens, so that, like, they can still build, like, the neural connections and whatnot to develop, like, coordination and to get better and whatnot, but they're not putting that in real life physical pain on themselves, and they're healthy for game day. Maybe there's some move to be made in running for that.
I absolutely think so. And there's definitely something to be said about, like, those seasoned veterans who have, you know, done a dozen or more 100 milers. They're the ones who seem to be the most dialed in the races. And I don't think that's a result of having practiced it more. But there might be a way for someone to get to that point a little bit sooner without having to have run 20 100 milers, because that might not necessarily be the most conducive thing to actually getting the best 100 mile performance out of you.
It's interesting. You said this earlier, that most of the people that have tried to go all in on the sport have been self-coached and it hasn't really worked out. I think you might've mentioned this offline, like, Chris Mako is an example where he did have this, like, incredible ride in a short amount of time, and he was putting in these huge weeks, and he quit his job and he was just all in, but it didn't work. I wonder if a lot of the bad reputation around going all in is due to the fact that they just try to put it all the responsibility on themselves. Like, when I go back to, like, Tom Evans' example, because he has this military background, he's actually said that he's more comfortable with delegating responsibility for making good decisions. So, like, he has all these coaches because he doesn't want to leave it to himself to make these decisions, because he would just do too much. But anyways, I think it was just a good point you made about the self-coaching, because I think that's a big issue with it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Perhaps in where the sport of ultra running was even 4 or 5 years ago, there was almost no one who would get the resources to be a full-time, like, professional ultra runner with professional coaching, all the bells and whistles. But as this sport continues to grow and get more competitive, and there's more money at the top end, that sort of lifestyle can be more realistic, I guess, if anything.
It's amazing. I'm a little bit of a sports historian. Like, I love, like, looking at the evolution of other leagues. And it wasn't even until the 1970s that NFL players for football went all in. Like, they were working in insurance and as salespeople and as teachers in the offseason. And the same goes for the NBA. There was a switch that flipped. And as soon as a critical mass of players had the resources to do it, the league was never the same, and everybody was either all in or they weren't there. But then I just think you've made this great point where, like, Kira D'Amato, for example, can run 219, and she's a real estate agent, and that's the best anyone's ever done. And it's better than people who have been running full-time have done. Like, Scott Faubel with Hoka Naz Elite, like, he's not putting up as good of times as other marathon runners right now that do it on the side. So maybe running is an anomaly. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone has their own story, and That's what makes every situation so unique. Because as much as we can dive into like why Scott is or is not running these times, him and a few people very close to him are the only ones that really know like the full, you know, scope of that story. Maybe he'll listen to this and want to chime in, and we'll just convince him to start running trails. Who knows?
Scott, if you are somehow listening, it would be an honor and a privilege for you to come on and talk X's and O's. I think I've said my piece on this. Is there anything else you want to add on this front?
I'm excited for a point in which the sport has a whole bunch of full-time professional trail runners. Cause you know, like the next logical step that will go in that is like a training camp or a team. And that's a whole can of worms that I know we'd both love talking about, is like, there will be funding for multiple ultra running teams, or like you go up to Kenya and you pay your way and go train with the greats for a training block. And maybe it is just a cycle of athletes in a spot. Like maybe it's Flag, maybe it's Park City, Mammoth. Like maybe there just needs to be a spot.
This is why we're going to have like 15 episodes, because we have to save that one. Deserves its own segment. That'll be a really good discussion. Cause you're right. I think it is. Yeah. I'll just leave it by saying, I think that I want to believe it's going to happen, because I just think that anytime anybody does something without focusing on anything else, special things happen, whether it's sports or some other line of work or profession, teaching. I just think that like the mind is at its best when it's uniquely focused on one or two things. So just as a fan of the sport, I'm excited about that. But you raised some points that I hadn't considered, so I'm going to think about it some more.
Excellent.
Let's, this next segment, I got to give Anthony Costales some credit for. Anthony's a local runner here in Salt Lake. He's actually lining up for Black Canyon. We'll talk about that in a second. We were just talking about like interesting themes that running podcasts could cover, and Track and Field already does this to some extent. So maybe we'll introduce it here in trails. It's bringing the theory of the butterfly effect to our sport by talking about potential what ifs. And the first one we're going to talk about, this was voted on Instagram, is what would happen if Jim Walmsley had never missed that turn at mile 90 of the 2016 Western States 100. And let's maybe start by just giving a little bit of context to listeners that aren't familiar. What exactly happened there?
So, I mean, Jim had this phenomenal year of ultra running. I'd have to go back and see what the exact races he wore, but I think he did Bandera and Lake Sonoma that year and crushed both. And then is like, I'm going to go to Western States. I'm going to break the course record. I'm going to destroy other people. I'm going to prove to you this ultra jogging sport is stupid. I don't think he might've said that like word for word, but that was the vibe a lot of people were getting. And those were the takes that the media was absorbing of like, who's this guy? He doesn't respect the sport. What's going on? He goes out and I mean, but is he in the lead by the top of the escarpment? I feel like he probably was.
I think he set like a CR on that segment too.
Yeah. So he goes out to your best and everyone's like, he's going to blow up. Like we've seen this a million times. Like this is just how it works. Like a new kid comes in, thinks he can run 100 miles. You know, he gets to Robinson Flat. He comes through Devil's Thumb, Michigan Bluff. And like, he just keeps going further and further under course record pace. And it wasn't a magical weather day or anything like that. Like, I know it wasn't the hottest day, but it was hot. And Twitter's just completely going nuts. And then all of a sudden between, I guess it was the highway or maybe the aid station before that, maybe it was Brown's Bar, which is now Quarry Road. Yeah. And the next one, nothing. Jim disappears, but Twitter and, you know, the coverage on the States course is not the most reliable, or at least it wasn't in 2016. So people are like, okay, well, he's probably just done by now. And they just, you know, the tweets just didn't go through. And then they're like, Andrew Miller has come through, you know, Highway 49 at first. And everyone's like, no, you're wrong. And then they're like, allegedly someone has saw Jim Walmsley walking on the highway. And I just remember like refreshing my Twitter being like, no, there's no way. And then we learn later that he missed a turn and went a couple miles in the wrong direction, essentially, before popping back out on Highway 49. And at that point, you know, the race was over in regards to winning and the course record. so many people were like, why didn't he just turn around? And just like, he was an hour up on Andrew. He could have won. It's like, well, what you're forgetting is like, even if you lose 45 minutes, you lose 45 minutes in between aid stations. And when you're running that fast, you're only taking as much as you need from one aid station to the next. So Jim went an hour plus without any additional food or water. He lost a bottle. The first bit of unraveling was crossing the river when he tried to Phelps it across.
Yes.
He lost a bottle to the American River down there. So, and that hurts a little bit, but that was just like one of the few signs of like, uh-oh, this could be a disaster. Like there's still 20 miles left, you know? Yeah. So that's kind of what happened. You know, Jim did get back on course and finish the race, and like huge props to him for doing that. But what happens if Jim doesn't miss that turn? And now that I'm actually saying it out loud, I had this conversation with Hal Kerner, like right after it happened at the running store, because I do work at Rogue Valley Runners from time to time.
What transpired?
Man, he thought that Jim was not going to get the course record, even if he didn't miss the turn, because of the river. And, you know, Hal knows that course so well, just with the amount of times that he's run it, and with he's paced and crewed. And he said, like, just watching it and like seeing it happen, he was like, nope. He's like, by the time he hit the river, I could just tell he was done. I was like, how could you tell? I was really only a couple of years into the sport at the time, but I was like, how could you tell? He's like, you just kind of know there's signs where maybe physically he still looked there, because, you know, Jim just has this like effortless kind of fluid gait. But when you start making mistakes like that, like not holding onto the rope when you're swimming through rapids, the chance of you then going 20 more miles without making a mistake is very low. So he said, had he not missed that turn, something else would have happened.
Wow. By the way, that was a perfect summary. And just to remind the audience, we are assuming in this segment that Jim somehow keeps his wits and he doesn't miss that turn. He gets to the finish line. At the very least, he wins Western States. So for the sake of argument, we're saying that he wins the 2016 Western States 100. In that world, in that universe, how is the rest of the ultra running world affected? How is the field affected? What happens in 2017 as a result? 2018, what does our sport look like now? Like, how big of an impact does Jim missing that turn have on like current events in our sport?
In this win, just for the sake of extra butterfly, he's got to break the course record, you know, even if it's just by like 5 seconds.
Let's do
it. Breaks the course record.
Okay. So he wins and he breaks the course record. He goes under whatever it was, 14 for the first try. Okay. What is your first example of a big impact on the sport or on that race as a result?
So there was two universes that I started thinking about. I'll go for the like more sane one first, being Jim wins Western States. He breaks the course record. That's good enough for him. And now he moves on and immediately switches over to the next big thing, which is UTMB. So then maybe now Jim just is one and done at Western States and just starts focusing on UTMB and or Hard Rock. And then that opens up the whole debate of like, well, okay, in those few years of him not focusing on Western States, like, does he figure it out? Does Jim now dominate UTMB the next year or 2 years later? Because he doesn't have to worry about states anymore.
The first thing that comes to mind in that example is, given the way he ran Western States that year, and let's imagine it was successful, does he decide to line up for UTMB in whatever, September 2016, if they allow it, or September 2017, and he runs it in that exact same way? Because there is that video footage in September 2017 of him like waiting up for Francois and Killian at aid stations. And he did bonk, and there was like an unraveling. He did finish fifth, but like, it wasn't like a classic gym race. Does he just decide to run UTMB in that same do or die balls to the wall fashion? And then how does that turn out?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no way Jim runs UTMB in 2016 and goes out conservatively, because that would have been the only race then of his trail running career where he would do that. So why would he deviate from his race plan then? Especially considering he just won the most historic 100-mile with one of the better course records. So like, why not do that at UTMB? Like, there's no fear at that point.
And then let's just assume that he does crash and burn, but it like captures his imagination in the same way that getting the Western States course right captured his imagination. And he just makes that his singular focus, like you just said, for all of 2017, all of 2018. You got to imagine that some wins pop up there, and then maybe Francois knocked off one year, or Xavier, or Pau,
Killian,
like crazy.
Yeah, I know. It, in conclusion, Western States has just gotten in the way of Jim's potential at UTMB for like 5 years now.
Well, here's another one. Does Jim retire from ultra running altogether as a result? Does he just basically say, I got this? This is
That was my other one. Jim crushes Western States just to prove everyone that ultra running is just a dumb sport. And he's like, cool, I'm going to, what does he do next? Maybe he decides, oh, you know what the real ultra marathon is? It's Comrades. That's the other one that everyone's wanted to see, like Jim attempt, is like, maybe he just goes in on Comrades and tries his luck at the marathon earlier. Who knows?
It's wild to think of a Jim Walmsley not in the sport, but given the confidence that he brought to Western States that year and the self-belief that he was going to get it right and knock it out of the park his first time, that would make it conceivable that that was all he needed, that he could nail Western States and then that'd just be like that wild ride that spring and summer of 2016. And then it was like a flash in the pan.
Yeah. On to Ironman.
Another interesting one is like, given how drawn out the rest of the Western States saga was, because he didn't get it right in 2017 either, do the Coconino Cowboys even form? And what do the careers of runners like Cody Reed and Eric Sensman and Jared Hazen and Tim Frericks look like? Because I'm of the mindset that the delay in Jim's career actually significantly benefited all those guys.
2017 was the year of the Cowboy. That was the year they made their pact to all qualify for Western States. Or was it 2018?
I think they were all crewing Jim at Western in 2017. And there's that famous photo. Maybe it's just before the river where they're walking it in, like all as a group, like everybody's run out to find Jim and Tim on the course, and they're walking back and it's like a pact was made.
So it had started. Yeah. As they're making their way down towards the river.
But like there, does 2018 happen? Does the whole Coconino Cowboys thing happen? And for people like me personally, who have been fascinated in the potential of trail running teams, that was the perfect case study in like, could this work? Or at least that was something to build off of in the future. So does that even happen?
Yeah, I think when you break it down individually, like Eric Sensman and Jared Hazen probably still find success in the trails because they were both running ultras prior to Jim running ultras. Cody and Tim, I don't know if they switched to trails as early. So I think they both ran at NAU up in Flagstaff. I know Cody did. I'd have to get fact-checked for Tim. They were both very good runners in college. Like I know Cody was a good steeplechaser and Tim threw down the pretty good 10K. So already being up in Flagstaff and having so much exposure to elite road and track, like, yeah, perhaps maybe they just go that route, maybe indefinitely, or maybe it just delays them for a few more years. But I think either way, yeah, you're right. Like the pact of the Coconino Cowboy might not exist, or at least have the impact it did in, to any degree that it did had Jim missed the turn.
It's wild to think, and like a couple more things can't come to mind. That group had such a cultural impact on the sport too. Like I think of all of these meme accounts, like the Cappuccino Cowboys, like which formed as a result of that on Instagram, which is just hilarious. And then there's knockoffs of that, like your boy Scott Jurek, which I'm not going to say is like totally related to that, but like the Cappuccino Cowboys set the tone for like ultra running humor. So are we even as funny of a sport as we are now because of that group and because of Jim Walmsley missing that turn?
Our sport's not mainstream by any means, but to at least have gotten a little bit of exposure on social media from a kind of funny standpoint, that's huge. And that doesn't always happen without the right people. So I think they have a lot of influence. Another thing that I really believe that the existence of the Coconino Cowboys and just young, fast post-college people getting into the sport of ultra running is just the level of competition a couple of years later, because they showed like, oh yeah, even if I know deep down, I'm not going to be an Olympian on the 5K or 10K, like I could potentially make a living doing trail things, which I'm honestly probably better at. There's really fast people now running ultras. Like that used to not be a thing for people racing 100 miles. You used to move up to the 100 mile because you were good at running a little bit hard for a really long time and not much else. Now there's Anthony Costalis. His marathon PR is 2:13.
2:13, yeah.
That is very, very fast. And he's trying to run Western States.
That's a great point. So a couple things come to mind. The first, maybe Jim Walmsley missing that turn and crumbling towards the end actually added legitimacy to the sport, because other talented track and field and road runners step back and say, wait a second, it actually isn't easy to like slog out 8 minute miles for 100 miles over the mountains. And this guy was one of the better runners in our sport. And like, he struggled to do it. So you know what, actually this is like a worthwhile endeavor, and it's like maybe harder and more challenging than I thought. So I think about that. And then I think about who are the Jim Walmsley inspired elite athletes in our sport now, like who is in the sport as a direct result of having watched Jim in 2016, 2017, 2018. Like I think of like Rob Krar as like V1 of this, like he's like the first guy who like had that track background and started having a ton of success. And I think that like maybe like Zach Miller and Sage and those guys maybe take a cue from him and enter the sport. But who came into the sport because of Jim?
Yeah, it's hard to say if they came in because of Jim, but who came in after Jim that coincidentally ran as good or better than Jim did on the track, which was very good. Hayden Hawks. Did he come into the sport because of Jim? We'll have to ask him. But he was very good at running at Southern Utah.
Very good.
So much to the point where he could have definitely tried to make it work on the track or on the roads post-college, but he decided to try the trail thing. You know, I think seeing that they ran very similar personal bests in college. And I think, I'm sure it was a matter of like, oh, well, if he can do it and he ran that, shoot, I might be one of the best then at the sport, which he was right. Matt Daniels.
Yeah.
Same deal. A sub 4 miler or around there, pretty fast.
It would be fun to pull some of the upper echelon athletes in the sport and just be like, hey, like what was that moment where everything clicked and you're like, I want to be an ultra runner? And what was your like intro to the sport story? Who inspired you? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that would be a super fascinating topic. Is like, what made you conscious of the sport of ultra marathon running?
Perfect. A couple more things on this topic before we go to Black Canyon. It's fun to game out the subsequent golden ticket years. So like Jim had to go back and get a golden ticket in 2017, went to Gorge Waterfalls. And if he hadn't been there, Tyler Green got robbed. Tyler Green got third at the 2017 Gorge Waterfalls 100K. He would have had that golden ticket to Western States. And he's one of the best runners in our sport right now. Yeah. I think he just got second at Western States. Like how much did that delay his progression in the sport, or at least at Western States?
Yeah.
And then 2018, Jim had to go back again, Lake Sonoma. And the guy who he knocked out was Drew Maycomber. So tough luck.
I know. Yeah. Hopefully they're not too salty about that still. Jim having to run extra golden ticket races.
What is all good things in all good time.
Yeah.
Let's talk Black Canyon, man.
Yeah. This is exciting. Yeah. There's always good storylines at Black Canyon. It's one of the more competitive golden ticket races. Just was it last week or a week and a half ago, they announced due to the unfortunate cancellation of the Tarawera 100K that they're moving a golden ticket on, you know, both the men's and women's sides over to Black Canyon. So now the top three will go to Western States. Like if you're on the podium, you have the choice to go to Western States if you want. And that's exciting.
Well, I'm looking at it right now. There's almost 800 entrants, 531 males, 227 females. Would love to see that get closer to 50-50, but that's another discussion. Ultra signup is really all we have to go on for contenders. And there's a couple of questions I think I want to ask you here. The first is, given the size of the race and given the depths of the field, it looks like there's a lot of competitors on the male side that could get tickets. Same with the female side. Mm-hmm. In addition to the golden ticket contention, is it just the top 10 that we still care about, or are these races getting competitive enough to a point where we can say it's interesting to think about the top 20 or the top 25?
If we're talking strictly fitness on the start line, there's more than 10 men and 10 women that have the potential to get a golden ticket on Saturday. There are absolutely more than 10. Does that mean it's going to be 10 people at mile 55 all gunning for those top three? Absolutely not. At least seven of them will have blown up by then, probably more than seven of that 10. So I think it's worth exploring more than just the top 10 of this race because it's just that good.
Yeah. One thing you just mentioned blowing up. I would love to poll runners before the race, what they expect their 50K time to be and what their overall finishing time is going to be and how well they hold to that, because I'm obsessed with this concept of negative splitting in ultras right now. And I'm wondering like how conscious of that ideal runners are, if they care about it at all, or if it's just like, I'm going to just gun it from the start and pray that I finish in good standing.
Yeah, there's more than two schools of thought to this, but there's definitely a good percentage of competitive ultra runners that are going to go out and they're going to race. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I'm fit enough to race the people at the front. If they go out hard, I can go out hard. I can out-survive them. If they go out slow, I can go out slow. I can outrun them. That, in a way, can cater towards certain runner types of just being competitive. There's the other group of, I'm pretty sure given the weather and my fitness, I can run this time. That time will get me a golden ticket or it will win. And coming from like a more of a track background, like 2 minutes in the 800, like that's a big milestone. And that's one of the probably most hot topics of distance, mid-distance track and field is, how do you run the 800? Do you negative split it or do you do a slight positive split? And it's very split. But at the end of the day, 159.9 always beats 2 minutes. It doesn't matter how you do it. Mm. That time is always going to beat 2 minutes. So if someone can just go out and be like, it's going to take 8:45 on the ladies' side to get a golden ticket, and I am going to pace exactly for that, which for this course, it's not actually even. Like the second half is slower than the first, but even effort, whatever that pace ends up coming out to, you might be in 20th place at the halfway mark. But if you are that good at sticking to your guns and just committing to that, statistically speaking, unless this is actually the most competitive year that the sport's ever seen, then yeah, then you're going to get a golden ticket.
Let me ask you a couple of coaching questions here before we start to analyze some of the runners. Yeah, when you put your coaching hat on, what does this course demand from runners to be successful? What would you expect competitors in this race to have done in training uniquely for Black Canyon to get this golden ticket versus what they would be doing at Canyon's 100K or Bandera or any of these other golden ticket events to get to Western States?
This course is tricky. I've never raced it. I've never run on any part of the course, but I've coached a handful of athletes towards this race. I have a lot of friends who run it. And the like most common thing I hear is they're like, wow, it was a lot harder in the second half than I thought it would be. The elevation profile shows a lot of flat and a lot of down in the first half and then rolling in the second half. But when you break the numbers down of it, most of the climbing of the race is in the second half. And if there's 5,000 feet of climbing in the race, 5,000 feet of climbing for 100K, not very much. 5,000 feet of climbing for 50K, okay, that's not easy. Throw that after 30 miles of any type of running, then it starts to get a little more difficult. And I've heard, especially from all my West Coast people, it's pretty rocky out there, especially in the second half. So you have to pay attention. Like you can't just mindlessly hammer. You have to look at where your feet are landing or else you will fall. I've seen a lot of pictures of bloody knees and bloody faces because people kick things because they get tired because the first half is a little bit too easy and the excitement level is very high and the weather is good and it's going to be fast. So, you know, I think some keys to success are like a lot of self-control in the first half. That doesn't mean putting on the brakes and going super slow on the first, you know, 30 miles, but I think it means having done something in your training that can allow you to descend relatively efficiently for a long time and then still climb with power. You know, like you got to be able to climb with purpose in the second half. And no, none of the climbs are that long, but that doesn't mean they're not there. Even if the climb is 2 minutes and you survive 1 minute of it, and then the second half, you're like, okay, I got to get to the top. And you have to slow down significantly. Like if you add that up over the course of 2 hours of climbing, it's like, okay, you've blown up for an hour total now. Like that's not conducive to running fast. So I think there's a lot more strategy that goes into this race than maybe a lot of people think about before they initially do it.
Well, let me ask you one more question. For the athletes you've coached, have there been any common themes for the ones that have been successful, I should say, in meeting their goals? Have there been any common themes in their training or in the way they executed the race that set them up for success?
So you don't have to pile on a ton of vert for a race like this. You do need to still have like, you still need to be pretty elastic and like be able to run. And I think I was just talking with David Laney about this just the other week, and that a lot of people get worse at climbing because they climb too much, which is a little bit backwards sounding, but there's an amount of springiness and elasticity you get and like just like efficient biomechanics that you get from running like threshold repeats on a track or on a flat bike path. And that kind of power and efficiency that you learn there, like for some reason can make you a pretty efficient climber, which is why there has been people who've had very high success in some like hilly to mountainous ultras while living in flat places like Casey. I mean, right. She's like the perfect example of
Casey.
Of how you don't necessarily need to be living in the mountains, climbing 20 grand a week just to have success in mountainous races. There's definitely an amount of efficiency and ability to just run pretty comfortably for a very long time that goes into success of this race. The other aspect is it's hot out there. It's hot and exposed. It's supposed to be like in the upper 70s, low 80s, that for pretty much everyone, that's going to feel like over 100 because it's early February. We have the nicest weather in the world right now in Ashland. It's 70 degrees. And that feels so hot. This is 10 more degrees and full sun. So if you haven't done what you need to do, whatever that may be, to prepare for the heat and know what your hydration, fluid, electrolyte levels need to be at, that can be a huge make or break part of the race as well.
I promise we're going to get to our picks and our analysis of the fields in a second, but I want to ask you, or I want to talk a bit about like how we've researched these athletes and prepared for this segment. And I'll start by saying, I really want somebody to fix and rebuild Ultra Sign Up because it surfaces so many people at the top that don't belong at the top. And it's also annoying because there's no way to track people that are up and comers and that relatively were unknowns and come out of nowhere. So someone's got to rebuild Ultra Sign Up and someone's got to create some version of Strava that allows you to be alerted to when people are training hard and hitting milestone workouts and they're nailing these B and C races before the main event, because at least I'm left to analysis by name recognition. And it's all based on like, oh, they did this one time back in 2018, or, oh, they're friends with this person, so they must be good. And that's where all my picks are coming from. So that's a little bit of a diatribe there, or a rant, but I'm just going to say that first. And I'm curious how you did your analysis, because I really struggled.
So what I did was I opened up a tab for the Aravaipa like main website that led me to their YouTube page. They did a handful of 20-minute interviews with a good chunk of people that are going for golden tickets. I didn't have the time to listen to all of them, but I listened to a good amount of them. I also opened up the entrance list and I right clicked and opened up a new tab for 50 to 60 of the top people on both the men's and women's side. And
let me just say one thing. This is why you're a co-host on this part of the podcast. You rock.
And I would be doing this if we weren't recording this and I just needed ammo to talk about it on a long run. Like this is just what I do in my free time. So yeah, I wrote down a bunch of notes. And so then of the ones looked at past race results of people, like to see what they'd done in 2021 or 2020. For some of those people, that led to me typing their name in on Strava, see if they're putting their training on Strava. I'll never know if it's all up there or not, but for a good chunk of people, I could see like, oh, their training block, at least according to Strava, looks very good. You know, and I took note of that for the ones that I was able to. Unfortunately, there's races that people do where the result does not make it to Strava or to Ultra sign up. Sorry. And that's just a huge bummer. I wish race directors that you just import your results to Ultra sign up. You don't have to host the signups. You don't have to pay your fee to use Ultra sign up as the way to sign up for the race. But after the whole thing's over, can we just at least import them back into Ultra sign up so we can just have all the data and all the numbers and like the passport of results for everyone just in one nice clean spot? Is that too much to ask? And if it is, any race directors listening, just let me know and I'll shut up about it. But as far as I know, it's not the most difficult thing to do in the world.
I also know a lot, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I also know a lot of runners who are begging race directors to affiliate with UTMB, for example, to get points for the race. Another discussion for another time, but yeah, that's awesome. And by the way, I want to say one thing about Aravaipa. I think that the tech and the coverage at this race is going to be state of the art. I'm really excited as a fan of the sport to follow. I think what Jamil does and what Aravaipa running does in general, building hype and then presenting the product and then doing like post-race analysis, it's probably the best we have right now. And so
I agree.
People that are listening should just be like, this is state of the art and rejoice. Like, this is awesome. They're really going to new heights.
Yeah. And that's exactly why the Black Canyon 100K, even though I've never been there and I've never raced it, it's one of my favorite races to watch and be a part of as a fan because of how well they do it just covering the race. I mean, even just, going to their own website, I was able to immediately go to their YouTube page and watch 20 previews where they got elite runners on their page talk for 20 minutes. And they straight up asked them at the end of every single one, all right, you're approaching the finish line. What place are you in? Like they asked good questions and that builds excitement for the sport. And I took some notes of that and I'll share some of those with you if you haven't heard already. There was also a link, you know, the preview is up for the live streams. They're going to have live streams going, or a live stream going, but with multiple cameras the entire time. Like it starts at 5:30 and it goes all the way until after the final hour of being able to qualify for Western States. So 18 hours plus is how long their live stream is going to go for. And they are going to have live coverage of both the men's and women's races. Like, yeah, there's definitely going to be some downtime in between sections of the course as it's extremely hard to live cover a point to point 100-kilometer course in the desert, but they do such a good job of keeping the viewers really as engaged as they can be.
And let me just say one thing. And that is, if you think that watching ultra running isn't something that can take off, I just want to remind the audience that there was a time when people thought that watching people play video games was weird, and now Twitch exists. So
I love how ultra running and video games have so many parallels. People are probably going to hate us for saying that, but it's so true.
Yeah. And we were talking offline just to increase the viewability of our sport. There's a ton of hope. Like, you sent me that YouTube channel of a guy who's, what is it? He sets up like mouse.
He races marbles.
Okay. He races marbles.
Yeah.
We'll link to it in the show notes, but there's just incredible potential. Like nothing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could make watching paint dry be exciting. I love watching running, but anyways, I'm just saying.
Yeah. Not to say running's boring, but like there's been a lot of media coverage in the sport of running that has made running boring. And I think with the right minds and the right people and the right stories, the right coverage, like they will absolutely make the sport exciting. And the folks over at Aravipa are absolutely doing that.
I just bookmarked that because that'll be a good segment for a future episode. What are the types of coverage and narratives that have made our sport not advance faster because they've been boring and stuff like that? So that's a good one, man.
Yep. That'll be a good conversation for another day.
All right. Absolutely. Let's start with the women's field. Who are some people in your research that you are excited about and why?
There's some like, I'm not saying veteran and like they're old or anything. There's some seasoned veterans in that there's some people who like when they show up to race, they can win. Like when they stand on the start line, they can win really any race. And there's like perhaps more ladies like that than men, just like, yeah, the running resumes. So, I mean, the four names that I wrote down were Devin Yanko, Addie Bracey, Yeo Wang, and Claire Gallagher. Those are four of some of the best ultra runners in the world for a course like this too.
I 100% agree. It's so weird to consider Claire Gallagher a veteran now. Like I think of her as this eternally relative newcomer to the sport that's like crushing it immediately, but she is a veteran now. She's been here for 6 years.
Yeah, no. And she's like consistently performed on, you know, the biggest stages. And that's not to say every single race is going to go great because that's just not the way endurance sports works, but she has been consistently a high performer for, honestly, if you can do it for more than 2 years, you're a veteran of ultra running.
It's great. There's a lot of attrition in the sport. So 2 years is like, it's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got those four from a veteran standpoint. Are there any people that might not be household names to the audience that should be on their radar nonetheless?
So someone that I came across that does not have a much, as far as I know, experience racing on the West Coast is Rachel Spalding.
She was my pick too.
Oh, look at us. We both did our homework on the same website. She has some good race results and she's been like crushing races. I think she maybe lives in Vermont. Most of her races were over in Vermont and she was like lighting up all the fields over there.
Shout out to the Beast Coast.
Crushed Old Dominion 100 mile, which
Hellgate.
Yeah, like Hellgate, 100K, like those are some good results. And now she's headed to Black Canyon. And I'm pretty sure she was one who had their training public on Strava and put in a good-looking training block. That's not always the most accurate. Like you can do the prettiest-looking training block and actually be completely torched by the time you get to the start line.
Oh yeah. Like Ryan talks about the risk of running your race in training.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't go through all of her last 16 weeks of running, but just choosing a few random weeks, I was like, okay, this looks like sustainable and like pretty good. So she might be one to be on the lookout for that, you know, maybe hasn't had their name called as much in some of these races. Cause I guess she's a relative newcomer to the stage this big.
Are there any other potential names?
There was a gal, Lottie Brinks. She got fourth at Javelina.
I saw that, yeah.
Javelina was competitive. Like that was its first year being a golden ticket race. I think the time was like 16 high. That's a good time. That's running in the heat. It's not as technical over there, but it checks a lot of the same boxes. So that would be another one. Of course, I'm a biased coach, like one of my own athletes and friends who lives here in Ashland, Natalie. I really hope she doesn't listen to this before the race. I might actually tell her not to, but I write all her training and her ultra signup does not show the recent success that she's had. And that's because we trained for a marathon and ran CIM in December. And she PR'd by like 17 minutes and ran, or 15 minutes and ran 2:45. That's pretty good.
That's amazing. Again, I wish there was like some feature where you could identify the stock of a runner that's trending upwards based on like consistency of training or because they've been out of the scene. Like,
That's something you're not going to see on ultra sign up here. You're not going to see anyone who ran CIM. Like, I'm pretty sure Anne-Marie Madden also ran CIM.
Okay.
Also in somewhere in the 240s. So if either of them have been able to, you know, recover from the race and get a little bit of their trail legs back, the pace will not feel that fast for them.
Who on the women's side, where are the three golden tickets going on the women's side, in your opinion?
Are we going, who's my top three in any particular order? Or am I just straight? Who do I think is going to win?
Yeah, who's going to win, but then who grabs the other two tickets? Like, so rank them in order.
I think this is Addie Bracey's race to win. She got fifth last year, but she's had some great races since then. The most recent one being the win at Run Rabbit 100. And I think I've overlapped with her at a couple races, and she's good. She's gritty. Like, when it's time to get tough, I've seen her be very tough. And I think that's going to be one of the keys to success on Saturday, not only just executing a good race, but then like, you're going to have to be that person that just wants it more in the last mile or two. My biggest question mark is Yeo Wang. I don't see any ultra sign up results from her since 2019, but she has dominated in the 50 mile to 100K distance. Like, that's her sweet spot. She's a 245, maybe even faster marathoner. So like, the leg speed's there. She's blown by me at Lake Sonoma, I think twice now. And just the way she can effortlessly pull away in the second half of a race, I'm like, okay, if she's showing up to this race fit, she will absolutely be a contender. Devin is the same way. She's so fast and she's had so much experience across. She might have the widest range of anyone in the field. I think she's like a 238 marathoner, and she got third at Western States. She won Javelina a year, a ton of amazing race results. If she shows up and has her good day, she might be the one to beat. But I think Addie Bracey has had some more, slightly more recent big results. Devin just did win the Arches 50K like just a couple weeks ago, and seemed to run that well. I mean, I have no idea what the effort level was like. Was it a full race, or was it just run it and win, make sure everything works? Like, I don't know. But these are some big names. And then Claire freaking won Western States in 2019. And she just always seems to like do it. It sounds like she's been in a good place with her running. Did a lot of training in Hawaii. It's pretty warm there. So I'm sure, and now this will be a dry heat. So, you know, it, weather-wise, she might be the best ready for the hot day.
So I've got total agreement on Addie. I got Addie Bracey for the win. I've got Anne-Marie Madden in second place. And then I've got Claire Gallagher eking it out in theatrical fashion to Yeo Wang, who takes fourth. So your three golden ticket winners, in my opinion, are Addie, Anne-Marie, and Claire. And yeah, to the point on Claire again, like, for her, it always seems like less is more. Like, she can run like 40 miles a week and still be one of the best runners in the sport because she's such a gamer. Like, she does remind me in a sense of Sabrina Stanley, not in terms of personality, but in the sense that like, when she's in it, like, you can just viscerally see like how competitive she is and just how she like gives everything on the course. And I love that. And yeah.
Yeah. Some people are not good at detaching themselves from the rest of the world and only focusing on the race. And she's very good at just like getting into that, I guess, that flow state. And like, it sounds, she was just on the Arvipa YouTube channel. I mean, it sounds like she's better at getting into that flow state because of all the time she's spent in the last, you know, year or two free diving in the ocean. Like, she can get to that point where she's dropping like 100 feet down with nothing. And she says that's not that impressive if you're a free diver, but I can barely get 10 feet down under the water. So just to have that sense of calmness.
Yeah.
I feel like that's one of those, like, that's going to be the mental trick, the mental aspect of training for this sport of ultra running that we were talking about earlier. Like Claire might have just unlocked one of the secrets.
And then both of our projected winners, Addie Bracey, she literally wrote the book Mental Training for Ultra Runners.
Yeah. Like that's like, I believe that's like somewhat her profession.
Yeah.
Outside of running.
So it's an interesting commonality in the top three. Let's talk about the men's side. Who are some familiar names that intrigue you? And then, let's start there. Who are some of the household names that you like?
So, probably the most familiar name, kind of funny, if you scroll down on the ultra signup list far enough, you get to Jared Hazen. And that's not a knock on Jared at all.
Well, he hasn't had a good race since the pandemic started.
I think, he hasn't had a great race.
I think he had that incredible 2019 Western States. And by the way, Jared's a veteran. He's been throwing up amazing results for the last 7 years, but it seems
26
like
years old.
Yeah,
26 Jared is 26 old. And he's been around
a grizzly 26-year-old veteran.
Yeah, no, you're right. His last like really significant race result was November of 2020, 12th at JFK, okay. 50 mile, which 6.5 hours. I mean, that's not...
He's a 5.5 hour guy.
Yeah, that's not something he's, proud of. And I know Jared has been one to run a lot, like more than Jim. He just hasn't always been fully active on Strava, but apparently Jim's out there throwing down 140 miles a week. Jared's putting in 160, 180, which is not new to him. Like when Jared got third at Western States in 2015, when he was like 18 or 19 years old. And apparently at that point, he was already like training well over 100 miles a week as a teenager. And has just always been able to do it. Is that something you can do indefinitely? I don't think so, as history has shown that those who are very, very high volume runners haven't been able to do it forever. I think you can do it strategically if you're lucky.
You know, that makes me think about, is there still room in the sport for people that can just brute force it with high mileage to be successful? And that's probably a discussion for another episode, but I think that's an interesting thing to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's the best way to train for Western States?
I got a soft track there.
Yeah. So for like in Jared's case, he appears to be putting most of his training on Strava, and his training block, unless he's hiding half of his mileage, I hope he's not. His training block looks great. He's been running like 90 to 100 miles a week with some hard workouts. He hasn't been climbing 30 grand a week. It's been pretty reasonable. And if he can show up on with good legs, like, he's a contender for sure. With how good the quality of this field is from a fast standpoint, 100K is starting to look a little short for Jared, which is crazy because he's actually pretty fast. There's a lot of names that haven't been around in the sport of ultra running for that long. There's a lot of like, I'm an upperclassman because it's my first day of junior year. Veterans to the sport right now on the men's side of this field. What names from the entrance list jumped out at you?
Got a couple. So a relative newcomer, Reed Coolset, who for folks who don't know about him, ran 2:10, was in the marathon, and he was on the Canadian Olympian team. He does have some ultra experience. He's not just some fast marathon guy coming in. I think he won the Quebec Mega Trail 110K, which I know that area of North America. It's technical terrain, so he's somewhat
seasoned.
That's
a big race.
It's a big race. It's on the Solomon Series.
And he got lost in that race, too.
But interestingly enough, so I think he could win the race, but I actually just talked with him a couple of days ago, and I have intel that he got a sponsor spot to Western States. So he's just racing for the win. He's not even going for a golden ticket. So even if he won, for example, it would go down three spots. Couple other folks, obviously Anthony Costales, who I'm rooting for because he's a Salt Laker. You mentioned Jared, a guy named Elliot Carden, who got third at Black Canyon last year. He's back in it. A guy named Adrian McDonald, who won Leadville last year.
Yep.
And then another guy that I just talked to, who I'm pretty jazzed for, Justin Grunewald, who I think he had a weird situation last year where he started in like the second wave.
Yeah.
And so he's like no man's land.
But he talked about that. They brought him on the RVIPA page. And so the wave one was the elite wave and it was 40 people. And he was like 41. And like that was just unfortunate.
I got one more for you, by the way. So my dark horse is, I wouldn't call him a dark horse because I think he's had some near misses at golden tickets. Jeff Colt.
Oh, I missed his name. Jeff's shown ultra running brilliance a couple times, but maybe just, I don't know if he's just always consistently tried to be on the top of the ultra running world. It seems like he's gone through brief ins and outs of essentially like training that hard in the sport. Yeah. I raced against him at Bandera 100K one of the years and totally smoked me. That's a good one. That's a good one.
So I think he's my dark horse and I'll just rattle off how I think this is going to play out. I got Anthony Costales for the win. So he's going to go to Western States because he's going to take a ticket. Mm-hmm. I've got Reed Coolset finishing second. I've got Justin Grunewald finishing third. And then I have got Jeff Colt finishing fourth, getting that golden ticket.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's out of left field, but I just want to go on a limb.
So, and for those who might be wondering, the rules for golden tickets going like down beyond first and second has always gone down to fifth and no further. So if there's like four people who were in the top 10 at Western States last year, all in this race, and they go one through four, there would only be one golden ticket handed out. That is still the case for this year, even though there are three golden tickets. So it's still, no matter what, only going down to fifth place. Okay. So you better be in the top five if you want to go to Western States. On the safe bets, just get yourself in the top three.
Just to review, Costales, Grunewald, and Colt are getting the golden tickets.
Yeah. Okay. I think I also wrote down, I think Anthony Costales is going to win. He hasn't really been very active on Strava. That's the only way I know him.
He's been putting in the work though. He's just not consistent there.
Yeah. So if he's as fit as when he raced the Canyons 100K last year, I think he will win Black Canyon because his run there was amazing. Like it was so good. That was a really cool race. So I think he's the guy to beat. I think it's Justin's time. He's going to get second. And like, he's not even going to be that far behind Costales. And Justin's been, he's been putting in the work. Like he's been running a lot. And like, he's fit. And the reason I say that with so much confidence is because in his interview with the Aravipa people, he also said he's fit and he thinks he can break the course record.
And I was talking with him also just the other day, and he told me that he's never been at a point in his running career where he's had so much fun, which I think is always,
that's huge,
a huge ingredient for future success.
Yeah. So I think Anthony and Justin are both going to run fast, and this is going to be Justin's, like, this is going to be his big break. I think this is the race for him. And I don't think it's going to be a fluke. There's no such thing as a fluke good run, only fluke bad ones, because your fitness is your fitness. So I think this is the race where he makes that jump and gets the golden ticket. Third is, gosh, so up in the air. I mean, I want to say Reed. It'll just come down to whether he's good at managing the heat and all of the potential mistakes that can be made in a race like this. Jared, he'll be good at mitigating those mistakes. I'm not sure what kind of legs he's going to show up with. And then, Adrian McDonald, that was the other person who I like, big question marks. He won Leadville. You win Leadville, you're a big deal. His training block on Strava has looked great. The biggest question mark is just, it's going to be hot. How much heat training has he done?
Before we go to another segment, any final thoughts on Black Canyon?
My dark horse for the race is Makai Clemens.
So who's he?
So Makai, I think he had some brief stints of training in Flag way back when. in like, you know, 2016, 2015 kind of days. Like, I know he's done some good running and he's had some good races, but he hasn't done much in like maybe 3 or 4 years. So then I popped over to Strava and I'm like, what's old Makai been up to? And the dude's been banging out like 100, 120 mile weeks the last few months over in South Korea. I don't know what he's doing there, maybe work or something related, but his training looks great. So there's my dark horse pick.
This next segment is a short one, but it's just a hot take that happens to be on our mind at the moment. I'll go first. My hot take, because I think you already mentioned yours earlier, but mine is, I think that all professional athletes, all professional ultra runners should be on Strava. Why am I wrong?
There's just too much. Where's the mystery there? You know, it's like there needs to be that slight like allure of how fit are they? I would love for every professional ultra runner to have a media team capturing awesome footage and snippets of them working out and like interviews of them saying, I'm really fit. This is the best training block I've ever done. But I don't think they necessarily need to share all their training, because that could also run into the problem of people ducking each other in races. I don't want that to happen either.
I think the reason why I feel so strongly about it is because this is one of the only areas of our sport where it's really easy for the fan to access some sort of data that brings them a connection to the athlete. Like, totally. Even when you think about the training of like Tom Brady or LeBron James or Brittany Griner or just any major professional athlete, a lot of what they do, most of those athletes in those sports, their training is somewhat mysterious, or at least the numbers around them.
Yeah.
And in our sport, it's mostly commonplace and a given that like these athletes it'll be out there, at least in the advent of the Strava era. So I think it's what makes our sport unique. And as a way to further differentiate, I just think it'd be awesome if they all did, because I think it would create more fandom.
Yeah, totally. It would be really exciting to see all of everyone's training leading up to a race and knowing like, oh, these people are fit. You know, I think from a like an athlete's perspective, that adds an additional level of stress and anxiety to the mix of people already get caught up in doing way too much and running way too hard and trying to grab as many crowns as they can. And now being the local legend of everything, which can hurt training. I mean, that's why like a lot of these pro track clubs, like they don't even, most of their people on the track, like aren't even wearing watches. They're just letting the coach yell out the splits, because like not even they want to know what they're doing.
That's a great point. What's your hot take?
So we already discussed it. The biggest thing is I just wish that race directors would upload all the results to Ultra Sign Up, so we could have just a little bit more cohesiveness with who's doing what. Because, and there's, you know, people like Tejas Trails, they publicize their entrance list for Bandera every year, but it's in alphabetical order. Like, who's that helping? I can't just go through the names and then Google every single person. Like, I need that ranking system of some degree.
I think you know what? I think I'm in full agreement. I think UTMB is also an offender. You can't see the historical record of results on Ultra Sign Up. And that is one of the worst websites of all time in terms of navigation. And I think they publicize it, but it's, you got to dig to find. So there's a lot of work we could do there.
I agree.
Okay. Let's talk about trail running news to conclude. And I think that the big news for this particular episode is the fact that we have a new elite athlete in the sport, a Garrett Heath. And for folks who aren't acquainted, what makes this such an interesting move in our sport?
So I've followed Garrett Heath and been a Garrett Heath fan ever since, you know, he was in college running at Stanford. And he's very fast. You know, he's like a 3:53 miler and broken 13:20 in the 5K. But one thing that has always been unique about Garrett is that he always punched so far above his weight in cross country. He beat like Mo Farah in cross country races, like a great Edinburgh cross country race one fall. He like spanked and doped up Ezbel Kiprop, who had just run like almost the 1500 world record. And then like Garrett Heath, who to the rest of the world was relatively unknown, just comes up and just destroys everyone. And his he doesn't have like the most beautiful looking stride, which throws some other people off as like, why is this guy running this fast? But like, that's always been his signature. And he's always been a really exciting runner because he's very brave and he's not afraid to just go straight to the front and start hammering if the pace is too slow or things like that. And on long runs in college, we always talk about like, you know, if someone should run trails, who should it be? And like, even afterwards, like who's from the track world would actually make a good trail runner. And Garrett Heath was always the first name that popped up because of how gritty he was. And he has finally announced that he is joining the Brooks Trail team, which Brooks is not a new sponsor to him because he was already running for the Brooks Beast Track Club in Seattle. But now he is just, I guess he has switched sports. Garrett Heath is now a multi-sport athlete and he is making his way over to trails.
I have so many questions here. I'll rattle a couple off. What part of the sport interests him? Like, does he want to go to ultras? Does he want to compete with Joe Gray and Andy Wacker on the sub ultra scene? Where is he living? Where is he training? Does he have a coach? Does he have training partners? So many questions unanswered, but I think you mentioned it. His background in cross country would make me think that the transition to trails would be relatively seamless and that he could make an immediate impact and he'd be successful.
I think he will be good at it if, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he could do it by himself, but I hope he has some people in his corner just to advise a little bit. But yeah, I'm really excited for what Garrett does in the trail world.
I don't know anything about his mindset, although you painted a picture of him being incredibly strong and just having courage and discipline. I wonder what like the first race that he participates in is going to be like and how important it is for him to be successful, or can he take an L or not a great experience and still be encouraged to double down on the sport? I always wonder about those first impressions after you've made the decision.
Yeah, I don't think losing, you know, maybe losing to someone who on a track he will beat 100 times out of 100, I don't think that will shake him because I don't know him personally, but the way he's always raced and held himself, that's just not the type of like runner he is. So like, if he loses, there will be something to be learned from it and he will fix it. And then he probably won't do that again.
Well, Brett, this has been awesome. I think this is the first of many episodes. I'm not exactly sure if we figured out what the cadence is going to be, but I think a lot of the format listeners experience today is going to be what we're going to roll with. Is there anything you're excited about in future episodes before we conclude?
There's already a lot of great races on the docket for this year. I mean, a lot of fun predictions to be had and those things might change too. I mean, we'll probably see a handful of people who, you know, if this weekend doesn't go the way that they want it to, we might see them at the canyons and that's really exciting. And we've got some good what ifs, some more butterfly effect scenarios. And, you know, I think there's just always good things to talk about regarding the sport that, you know, really only get like, they definitely get talked about, but I think they only get talked about on long runs and not enough like publicly on podcasts or whatever this is.
Maybe that's our, I think you stated it perfectly. Maybe our mission is to bring the banter of the long runs to a wider audience. And I think we got a bunch of different content formats and up in our minds that we're brainstorming and maybe those mm-hmm. will make appearances on future episodes. But like you said, I love the what ifs. I love the debate questions, and I'm sure we'll do more analysis on future Golden Ticket stuff. What's up?
I do. One last thing that we actually forgot to do was my fun Strava find for this
episode. Oh, okay. We got to do it.
I have two, but I'm only going to share one because, yeah, we don't have time for both. My first one is I found Zach Miller on Strava, and I guess maybe you have to find him. Maybe we'll put it in your newsletter, but I found Zach Miller on Strava and he has been logging some serious volume, mostly on skis, a bit on foot, but on skis and snowshoes. But like Zach's getting a big base for something and it's exciting.
You have to say the other one because this is too good.
Okay, fine. twist my arm, why don't you? I also found Timothy Olsen's training on Strava. A lot of people follow him on Strava, but a lot of people have probably never popped open Strava on a computer and looked at September 2010 to June 2012. That was essentially like his, Tim started running pretty much in 2009. Like, he wasn't a runner prior to 2009. In 2010, if you look at it on Strava, we have September to June. There's definitely some bits missing, but by September of 2010, Tim's logging like well over 100 miles a week, all in Ashland here, which is quite hilly. So, you know, he's running 120 to 140 miles a week with 25 to 30,000 feet of climbing. And it's just a glimpse of kind of the classic old school gritty ultra. Like, I'm going to run a lot. I'm going to run it pretty much all at the same pace. And if I break, but if I don't, I'm probably going to get really good. And we only really hear stories about it, but turns out there's a little chunk of his training that exists on Strava. So I encourage everyone to go check it out and like probably don't replicate any of it because there's only one Tim Olsen, but it is fascinating to look at and go through.
You made me aware of this on our prep call for this episode. I went and looked and I was blown away. Cool that he was in Ashland at that period of time. The amount of volume, and he wasn't going slow. He doesn't have these like amazing workouts that he was like knocking out of the park, Jim Walmsley style, but
he's not going slow,
but he wasn't going slow. And he was doing it day after day. And like his shortest day was like 2.5 hours time on feet. Just insane. Yeah. This is why I love Strava. It captures these amazing eras of our sport. And how lucky are we to be able to see Tim Olsen from the beginning?
Yeah. I'm just glad he was an early adopter, and that makes living in Ashland like really fun and cool. It's like, you know, I still get to talk to and hang out with Hal, and he has lots of stories like this. Like, Tim was not the only one running 140 miles a week in the Ashland trails. There was a whole group of people in the mid 2000s that were doing that.
Dude, this has been awesome, man. I'm stoked to start thinking about the next one, which I don't know when it's going to come, but hopefully soon. I think this is going to resonate with the audience. We're experimenting with a new format here, and we'll see how the trail running world takes it. But this has been awesome, and I can't thank you enough.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I'm already looking forward to our next chat.
Hey, thanks as always for listening. We are always curious to get your feedback on new episode formats and types of content. So let us know. And we also just love listener input in general. So if you have any ideas for future episodes, especially contributing to our What Ifs segment or just any particular compelling debates in our sport right now, we want to hear from you.